Got to get all this technology set up here. My wires are literally crossed. Is this thing on now? Yes? Okay, great. No? It is on. It's just not very loud. So there's the thing where you turn it up, right? Oh, there you go. Well, it's great to be here. Come back to my home area. You know, I just moved out of San Diego, where it was probably about 65 or 70 degrees today and sunny. I am a UConn guy. We played UMass back in the day, and I assume we just totally destroy UMass in basketball. No, I assume that we do. But I'm sure in hockey you guys would trounce UConn. That's right. Okay, great. So anyway, let me tell you a little bit about myself. So I was raised going to church, a very traditional denominational church. And I was, in the youth group, in the president of the church youth group. But the problem was I didn't believe in God. I was an atheist. How that worked, it was okay. I don't know. That was an interesting church situation. So I went off to college, and I was actually pretty proud to be an atheist. I remember the Christian guy in the dorm sharing his faith. We're laughing at that guy. But then, as I studied physics and chemistry, I came to believe that there's a God. And so I eventually came to Christianity, kind of like Francis Collins. You know who Francis Collins is? Head of the NIH. He's a mere Christianity believer. Started out as an atheist as well. So the reason I came to believe in God was because of science. But that started me on a journey of 2 or 3 years. I was first interested in like Hinduism and Buddhism and all that kind of stuff. And then eventually I began to read the Bible, and I realized the Bible is consistent with facts and information. So I became a Christian. That was about 40 years ago. So what I'm going to do today is I'm just going to cover some really, really basic physics, chemistry, biology, that tells me why a scientist certainly has to believe in God. All right? And so I've been a chemistry and physics professor for many, many years. So I'm just going to go over some pretty basic stuff. Now, there's a couple of possible perspectives. The first would be of the atheist. The atheist idea be represented by our friend Thomas Huxley. I don't know if you know who Huxley is. Best friends with Charles Darwin. I think his nephew was Julian Huxley, who wrote Brave New World, Aldous Huxley. Anyway, he said, "We are as much the product of blind forces as is the falling of a stone to earth, the ebb and flow of the tides. We just happened. And man was made flesh by a series of singularly beneficial accidents." All right, so that's one perspective, which is that there is no design. And everything here, it just happened by accident. That's what the atheist believes. Now, at a lot of universities, it's kind of assumed in science departments, well, obviously all scientists are atheists, because how could a scientist ever believe in God? That's kind of the atmosphere there. But I'm telling you, I'm going to show you that I believe this really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Another person who might represent this way of thinking is a more modern guy. His name is Richard Dawkins, who wrote The God Delusion, right? He said, in the universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky. You won't find any rhyme or reason to it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at the bottom no design, no purpose, no good, and no evil. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares. It just is, and we dance to its music. Again, same idea. All an accident. No purpose, no design. And that's the atheist idea. And the question I'm going to ask tonight is, does that make sense? That's where I came from. That's where I came from as heading into college. I remember studying philosophy as a freshman, and we studied Nietzsche. And Nietzsche said, God is dead. I was like, yes. I don't know, Nietzsche's dead, and it seems like God's still doing okay. But all right, there you go. All right, so I need to borrow somebody's cell phone. All right, thank you. All right. So the other idea is the idea of design. Okay, so this idea was first invented by William Paley. He used a pocket watch because this is in the 1800s. That's what they had. So I'm going to change the pocket watch example to the cell phone example. So let's imagine that you saw that thing sitting there, and you're thinking, how did that get there? Well, I don't know. You know, there's some metal, some glass, some plastic, some silicon. Maybe the car went over it, and people came around, boom, cell phone. What do you think? That would that perspective be crazy, like insane? I've got a question. Which has more intimate design in it, the cell phone or the simplest living thing? The answer is, that's a simple question. The simplest living thing has far more complexity in its design than the cell phone. And there's people who actually believe that something like this can emerge by accident, by molecules bumping into each other, blind, pitiless indifference. I'd say even the simplest life coming to exist out of nothing, it'd be kind of like this. Let's imagine you have a junkyard full of, you know, wood, dirt, glass, you know, all kinds of stuff. You know, a tornado goes through there, and next thing you know, you have a 747, you know? Doesn't seem likely. So rather than the watchmaker argument, I think I'll go for the 747 argument. Now, stay off this phone during this lecture, okay? A few years ago, I was lecturing, and a cell phone started going off in class, and I stopped the class. I'm like, It kept going off. All of a sudden, oh, it was mine. So I've learned to have grace on that one. So what I'm going to do then is I'm just going to mention a few facts that are absolute incontrovertible facts about nature that says to me the idea that God does not exist cannot be supported by rational thinking. Despite the fact that, as you know, there's this idea out there that obviously a scientist would never believe in God because only, you know, I don't know, uneducated people would believe in God. So let's talk about water. Hopefully, since you had the H and the O and the H, you didn't need that label there. Hopefully you knew who that was. You know, you could teach an entire one semester course just to explain the origin of the properties of water, all these unique properties of water, every single one of the properties that water has, which are unique to water. If water didn't have that property, there'd be no life. And we could argue for accident, right? Our friends here, accident, luck, no purpose, no design, as the atheist believes, or we could argue for design. All right, so a few facts. Number one, life requires a liquid. You can't have a living thing based on something that's a solid or a gas, so it has to be a liquid. And that liquid has to be liquid in a fairly narrow temperature range. Chemists and physicists would tell you somewhere between around minus 20 centigrade and about 80 centigrade, it would have to be a liquid. But actually, it's better if it's not a liquid across that entire range, as I'll say in a little bit. All right, so water happens to be liquid in the correct temperature range, but what's interesting is water is bent at about 105 degrees. It turns out if water was linear instead of bent, and if you connect three things, the logical shape is linear, all right? If it was straight instead, water would boil at around minus 150 degrees centigrade, and we would all be vaporized. That wouldn't really work very well at all. Now, in order for life to exist, you have to have a solvent, and that solvent has to be able to dissolve a wide range of substances. Water dissolves a wider range of substance of all liquids in the universe. Also, in order for life to exist, that liquid would have to be able to dissolve ionized compounds, ions. Guess how many liquids in the range between 20 and 80 centigrade dissolve ions? Only one, and that's water. And without ions, you can't have a nervous system, and you also can't have life. All right, water has a number of other properties. One property of water that's interesting is water absorbs more heat by far than any other substance. In fact, twice as much as all substances, and more like 10 times as much heat as almost all other substances. So what's interesting is the compound that has the right boiling point is the one that has the right solvent properties, just so happens to be the one that also absorbs more heat. Why is that important? Well, if it were not for that, the temperature of the Earth would go up and down by 150, 200 degrees centigrade in any given year, and life would disappear. But water has a number of other unique properties, completely unique to water. Now, you're probably new, I think, because you do live in Massachusetts. See, in California, we don't know about this, but here you probably knew that ice floats on water, right? All right, there are millions and millions of compounds. Guess how many compounds have the solid floating on the liquid? One, exactly one. It's called water. Good guess. You were really close. You were off by only one. You could have guessed 50, and then it would have been way off. Now, if we do the proportion how he's off, he's infinitely far off, but anyway. All right, and why is that important? Because in the winter, the colder ice floats on top of the warmer water. And then there's this other bizarre, totally bizarre property of water. All other substances, as you heat them up, their density goes like this. Guess how many exceptions there are? Only one. And it's water. Water has the property, as you heat it up, it goes like this, except when it hits 4 degrees centigrade, it does that. Which is why the colder ice floats on top of the colder water, which floats on top of the warmer water. Otherwise, lakes would freeze to the bottom in the winter, and during ice ages, the oceans would freeze to the bottom, and all life on the earth would disappear. I could talk about the viscosity of water and all these other things. Now, you could argue it's just an accident. You know, it's just lucky. To me, we're just talking about water, and we're going to keep going for a few more minutes. At some point, to not believe in God, I believe, becomes irrational. And I want to suggest that you probably should not be intimidated by these really smart, bald people with glasses who tell you that if you knew science, you wouldn't believe in God. Let me tell a story. I was in a van a few years ago, about 8 or 10 of us. It was a bunch of science professors driving between two venues at a conference. And this one woman said, "Christianity, what a stupid religion." Notice she's assuming everybody in this van is with her on this, right? It's obvious, right? She said, "Did you know that in Christianity, in the Old Testament it says, if you wear clothing with two or more materials, capital punishment." What a stupid religion. And I said, "Excuse me, but the Bible doesn't say that." She said, "Yes, it does. I saw it at a website." And I said to her, "You know, people say the Bible's full of all kinds of science errors." I said, "You know, I've read it through half a dozen times. I haven't found one yet. I don't know what they're talking about." Can you imagine how quiet it got in that van? And then guess what I did? I pulled out my Bible. Now, I had to do a quick prayer. Could you find the verse in Leviticus that talks about clothing of two or more materials? Now, I had my 1970 NIV, and I knew it was on the right-hand side about halfway down, so I did a quick prayer, and I found it. I read the scripture. Don't be intimidated by these people. Do not be intimidated by these people. Anyway, let's get to the... some of you are probably sweating, you know, just that picture up there. It's like chemistry PTSD, right? Now, I tell my students that this chart was invented by a Russian chemist. His name is Mendeleev. Actually, I was in Kiev a couple of years ago, and I was lecturing in the lecture hall that Mendeleev actually lectured in. And he's actually Ukrainian, but we'll call him Russian. It's all right. Anyway, so it turns out that God's fingerprint, I believe, are all over this chart. There's at least 22 elements that I know of that have a property that no other element has. And if that element didn't have that property, then there'd be no life. And to argue for an accident in this kind of thing, I believe it causes us to question the rationality of a person who would say that. Now, anybody take a little chemistry? We've got some UMass students. We're going to compete. UConn students, UMass students, all right? Who gets it right first? Which element am I going to talk about first that has properties unique to allow for life? Thank you. All right, which school do you go to? Smith! Girl power! Girl power! All right. Very good. I teach organic chemistry. And the first week in the organic chemistry class, I spent the entire week talking about the properties unique to carbon. Every single one of those properties, if carbon didn't have that property, there'd be no life. I love this because my students figure out right away I'm a believer. And I kind of do this stuff. I kind of go, you know, ha, ha, ha. You know, not ha, 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 but, you know, it's like, I told you so. All right, for example, one thing about carbon is carbon forms four bonds. Actually, it's not the only element that forms four bonds. There's actually two elements that form four bonds, carbon and silicon. The problem with silicon is if you put two silicon atoms together in a molecule, it explodes, which would not really work for forming life. Now, why is four bonds important? The reason is because until you get four bonds, the molecules are only two-dimensional. But once you get four bonds, you have three-dimensional molecules. And if you don't have three-dimensional molecules, you don't have three-dimensional life, which is the only kind of life there ever could be. Now, it just so happens the only element that has this four-bond structure also happens to be the only element that forms large molecules. And as I say to my organic chemistry students, also the only one that forms ring structures and single double, all this other stuff that I'm not going to mention right now. All right, and again, if carbon didn't have every single one of those properties, there'd be no life. Let me see. Another one, let's go back to our periodic chart. Another one I want to mention is iron. Iron's got an interesting, unique property. Iron is the only element that forms a strong magnetic field. And why is that important? So that your parents can put your homework on the refrigerator, right? No. Here's the deal. Now, in order for life to exist, we need energy to come from outside of the planet to kind of catalyze the, you know, high energy life forms. And so it comes from a very hot place. We call it the sun, right? From a star. And the sun, something like 90% of the energy from the sun is the form of visible light, which is lucky for us because only visible light can initiate reactions without blowing apart molecules. But there are two kinds of radiation that comes from the sun that would destroy all life. And there's two elements, one each, that prevents that from destroying life. And one of those, of course, is iron, because the magnetic field of the Earth created by the iron, it deflects the high-energy charged particles from the sun. Otherwise, it would destroy all life on the surface. In fact, the idea of taking humans to Mars, they've got a big problem, because you can't use a magnetic field to protect that spacecraft. All right, so, but here's the interesting thing. Again, exactly one element that forms a strong magnetic field. But here's the coincidence, if you want to call it that. Turns out, when you study nuclear chemistry, you find out that iron has the most stable nucleus of all the elements. Therefore, what's the Earth made out of mostly? Iron. Now, both things have to be true at the same time. In other words, the most stable element also is the only magnetic element. Otherwise, there'd be no life. And atheists think it's just an accident, just luck. So you see why I became a believer in college. I had no choice. Well, I guess I had a choice, but, you know, like it says in Romans 1, you have to essentially choose to not believe. All right, we could talk about the other kind of energy that comes from the sun that would also destroy all life, and that's ultraviolet radiation. So then we have another element. It's called oxygen. The cool thing is there are two forms of oxygen. Both are absolutely essential to high-energy life forms. One is oxygen, which is down here at the surface. Ozone, which is very poisonous, yet doesn't exist down here on the surface. It exists in the upper atmosphere, and it absorbs ultraviolet radiation. I could talk about the unique properties of helium, the unique properties of hydrogen. I'll just do one more element, and that's uranium. Now, you probably think uranium is dangerous, right? Why do you think uranium is dangerous? Because it's radioactive. Actually, believe it or not, uranium itself is not all that dangerous. Believe it or not, not that you want to have it just spread around your house, but it has a very, very long half-life. Luckily for us, uranium has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. Why is that essential? Because The uranium inside the earth produces heat, which keeps the inside of the earth hot. Why is that important? Because then you can have plate tectonics, which is like a massive recycling system without which the surface of the earth would become sterile. And also, without plate tectonics, you wouldn't have an atmosphere. So if you want to go to a planet without uranium, go to Mars. Almost no uranium, right? And of course, not much of an atmosphere and not a whole lot of plate tectonics. What's interesting is uranium is really, really dense. So where's almost all the uranium? In the center of the Earth, producing heat so that we could be alive. So again, as a scientist, I see God's fingerprints all over that periodic chart. Now, another example is DNA. And it's kind of geeky, but when I teach about DNA, when I teach biochemistry, it kind of, you know, kind of gives me chills, you know, the hair on the back. I mean, it's so amazing. The level of design in this molecule is absolutely mind-boggling. Okay, you're probably aware of the whole AGCT thing, yes? All right, what this is, it's a code. So these are nitrogen-containing molecules represented by this structure here, but they create a code, and three of those code for an amino acid in order to create a protein. Let me ask the most straightforward possible question. Could a code be created by molecules randomly bumping into one another? Could anybody believe that? Yes. They're called atheists. But why do they believe that? Is it because of the evidence or because of their philosophy? I'll let you decide. But I'm telling you, we're talking about a lot of information. There are 3 billion of these base pairs in human DNA. Let's try to imagine the simplest conceivable living thing. Certainly not 3 billion base pairs. Maybe a bacteria, maybe E. coli, 100 million. All right, let's say 50 billion. Oh, never mind. Let's just say 25 million base pairs, where we're getting on the edge where you could even imagine it could be a living thing at all. That's 25 million pieces of information. How could that information be generated? One rule of nature is nature does not develop information. I mean, the second law of thermodynamics does not allow for this. So what are the chances that this 25 million pieces of information could randomly assemble itself by just these molecules that have to exist already anyway to form DNA for a living thing? To use the analogy, it would be like this. Let's imagine I take 25 million letters, I throw them into the air, and when they land on the ground, you could read it. In what language? Let's pick a language. In Khmer or something like that. I mean, is that possible? The answer is, no, that's not possible. This information could not be produced by any conceivable random process. And, you know, scientists try to create the impression that there's all these theories to explain how this happened. Let me tell you, there is no theory to explain how this happens. There is none. There's a reason that there's none, I believe. Now, here's the thing. It turns out the only thing in the universe that makes proteins is DNA. But the only thing in the universe that makes DNA is proteins. Because proteins do the work, and DNA contains the information to make the proteins that do the work. So here's what the atheist believes. The atheist believes that in the same place, the 25 million base pairs happen to just randomly have the right connection so you have all the DNA for a living thing, but the proteins that would have made that weren't there. So in other words, nature had to make the proteins that would make the DNA and the DNA that would have made the proteins simultaneously in the same place. You know the chicken and the egg, you know the whole chicken and the egg thing? I'm telling you, the chicken and the egg is nothing compared to this one. You know what? It takes incredible faith to be an atheist. I just don't know how they do it. I mean, you have trouble as a Christian having faith that God could find you a spouse or get you a job. I mean, I'm telling you, those atheists, just talk to them about faith. Because they actually believe that this could happen randomly, right? You saw those quotes, right? A long series of singularly beneficial accidents. I'll say, yeah, that's singularly beneficial. So this is why I became a believer in God. Nature creates order. Nature spontaneously creates order, such as those huge crystals. That's a lot of order. But what nature never, ever does is create information, because it can't. So where did that information come from? Well, what do you think? I think it's fairly obvious. All right, great. It's a nice slide. Charles Darwin himself said, it is mere rubbish to think at this point of the origin of life. One might as well think of the origin of matter, which, by the way, they have a theory for now. Let's do a little physics. Yes, physics. I'm not getting much interest in physics. So, all right, we got a couple of physics guys. All right. Now, before the 1940s, physicists were unanimous that the universe was eternal. Now, why did they postulate or hypothesize that the universe was eternal? Was it because of evidence that the universe is eternal? No. It's because there's really only two choices. Either the universe is eternal, or it was created. Seems like those are the only two options, all right? But if the universe was created, that implies a creator. So for philosophical, not scientific reasons, the accepted model was the eternal universe. But then I think you're probably aware of this thing called the Big Bang, right? And so in the 1920s, the work of Hubble and others, Gamow worked out the theory, it became clear the universe is expanding at a very great rate. And, of course, physicists immediately said, oh, you're right, the universe was created. No, it didn't exactly happen that way. They came up with the steady state theory to protect atheism. But then in the 1960s, they discovered this microwave radiation that pervades the universe, which is the leftover radiation from this initial event. So guess what scientists now, I would say, universally accept? It's that the universe came into existence from nothing. In other words, before this event, there was no mass, no energy, not even space or time. And in a flash of light, from nothing, the entire universe came into being. Like Genesis 1:1. Are like Hebrews 11:3, which says, by faith we know that the things that are seen were created from something that is unseen. And I say, we know that by faith, but we also know it from science. So thank you for catching up with the Bible on that one. So now physicists kind of agree with what scientists, what chemists were saying. Physicists now agree with what Christians were saying all along, which is the universe is created. Now, I'm going to do a thing tomorrow night. How many people are there? I'm going to talk about the Christian worldview and talk about how other worldviews don't agree with this, including Eastern worldviews. All right, so next, what about that event? As scientists began to look at this event that we now call the Big Bang, which, by the way, was not an explosion, it was a creation. It was not an explosion. It was a creation event. Anyway, what they noticed is, in order for this to work, certain parameters had to be very, very, very finely tuned. For example, in order to have a working universe, there's this thing called gravity. All right, now, the electronic force is the thing that holds molecules together and atoms together. And then nuclear strong force is what holds nuclei together. But gravity is what creates planets and galaxies and stars. Here's what they discovered. Now, would you agree that that's a small number? 59 zeros and a one. I'm going to apply this to gravity. Just give me a second here. Let's say you had a friend who won the big lotto. What would you say? Awesome! Now, wait a minute. I thought you were a Christian. What are you playing the lottery for? But never mind all that. Let's say your friend won the big lottery again the next week. And then they won the big lottery again the next week. You ever see the show Slumdog Millionaire? It's kind of like that, you know what I'm saying? Actually, the probability that gravity would have the right size, as I'll talk in a minute, it's the same as the probability of winning the big lottery six times in a row. And if you won the big lottery six times in a row, you know where you're going to be, right? In jail. Well, here's what they discovered. Again, we're talking about fine-tuning. What they discovered is if the force of gravity was larger than the actual value by that proportion, the universe would have collapsed almost as soon as it was created. On the other hand, if the force of gravity were weaker than it is, by that fraction again, the galaxies and stars would have never formed. So let's just say you create a universe just randomly. Now, first of all, a good question is, why do we even have gravity? Can the atheist explain that? In fact, why do we even have the universe for that matter? Can the atheists explain that? Of course they can't. But let's just say we have a universe with gravity. What's the probability that the gravity would have the right value? Well, there you go. It's right there. So what's the probability then that it's just all an accident? I think it's right about that. Would you want to play those odds? There's people who do play those odds. They're called atheists. Now, there's way too much information on the slide. Don't even try to take it in. Just trust me when I say that there are dozens, there are literally dozens of parameters that define how the universe works. There are four principal forces: nuclear strong, nuclear weak, electromagnetic, and gravity. All of those are timed to great precision. The thing is, the electrical force is 10 to the 24th times more strong than the gravity force. And yet they're tuned to within a few percent. For example, the nuclear strong force, a couple of percent stronger, there'd be no hydrogen and no stars and no life. Just a couple of percent weaker, there'd be only hydrogen and also no life. Some of the things are tuned to one part in a million, others to one part in 10, others to one part to 10 to the 10th, but the gravity force is tuned to one part in 10 to the 60th. And in order for a functioning universe to exist, in which we could be here, these all have to have the correct value. And the idea of trying to fine-tune all of these parameters simultaneously, the human mind cannot even take in how insanely improbable this is. And yet, like we saw from Dawkins and from our friend Huxley, just a singularly long series of beneficial accidents. I'd say that is very beneficial. All right, Fred Hoyle said, a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as chemistry, and I haven't even talked about biology because I don't teach biology, so I'm not talking about biology. There's Anthony Flew, the most well-known, aggressive debater for atheism throughout most of the middle part of the 20th century, who became a deist just a few years ago because of this argument. Okay, we could talk about a bunch of other stuff. All right, so I'm going to conclude the first half of my lecture. We could go to Romans 1. Right, verse 20, where it says, it's from the very beginning it's been obvious, so that men are without excuse for not believing. And I would say, you know who has the least possible excuse for not believing in God? It's the scientist. How could they not believe in God, given the information that I just related to you? So again, don't be intimidated by people say, you know, no scientist could ever believe in the supernatural. Based on what? They'll say things like, science proved there is no supernatural. Well, that's a nonsense statement. You know that? That is a nonsense statement. Science, which deals with the natural, how could a form of study that deals with the natural decide whether the supernatural even exists. That when you hear atheists saying this, they're literally speaking nonsense. All right, so what I want to do is I want to start the second half of my talk. All right, great. So at this point, what we've established, I believe, by this evidence is, number one, there is a designer. And therefore, the universe is created by a designer. All right, great. That's where I was as of my senior year in college. That didn't bring me to Christianity, though. I'll just tell you right now. It did not bring me to Christianity. It brought me to believe in God. In fact, to search for God. And I, you know, did one of those, you know, things that college students do, young college students. And so I started investigating every possible religion. And I'll tell you right now, the first place I landed was in Hinduism. Or some mysticism, a kind of a Buddhist Eastern religion thing. But then, you know what happened? I picked up a Bible. And I started reading. I'll tell you this, I was not convinced that the Bible was inspired by God initially from scientific things, honestly. I came to this later on. All right? But I believe that the God we're talking about is the one that's described in the Bible. So I'm going to talk a little bit about science and Christianity, or science in the Bible. Here's a quote from Dallas McCown, a well-known biologist, atheist, a pretty good guy. He said, "Christianity is scientifically unsupported, probably insupportable, philosophically suspect at best, disreputable at worst, and historically fraudulent." Okay, thank you for saying that. All right, now, my response to that would be, this person is saying that the Bible is full of fables and legends and untrue historical facts. All right, can you give me one? Can you give me any definite historical statement in the Bible which is not consistent with what we know from history and archaeology? My study of this is, no, there is none of that. So why do they say things like that? Ask them. Ask Mr. McCown. Can you give me an example? And also, like I said, I shared in that van with my fellow chemistry, my fellow science professors. You know, people say the Bible can't possibly be justified with science, and yet I've read it a few times, and I am a science. I'm kind of a skeptical guy. And if there was a science error in there, I don't know, I think I would have found it by now. I just haven't found one. In fact, what I find is scientific wisdom. Now, be aware of this. The Bible is not a science book. And we should not read it as a science book. Specifically, when you read, say, Genesis 1, don't read it as a scientific account. That is a theological account describing what God did. But here's what I found. Every single time you have a definite statement in the Bible that relates to scientific things, the Bible is correct. And it's consistent. So I want to talk about that just really, really briefly. Give me about another 15 minutes, and then we'll do our Q&A session. All right, great. So this is Papyrus Ebers. This is the most well-known medical document from ancient Egypt. Now, scholars would tell you that the two most advanced cultures in medical knowledge in the ancient world were probably the Chinese and the Egyptians. And what this is sort of a PDR, physician's desk reference, from Egypt from roughly 1500 BC. The timing is significant because this is roughly when Moses lived. All right, so let's see some of the prescriptions in Papyrus Ebers. To prevent hair from turning gray.
Come on.
All right, prevent hair from turning gray. Anoint it with the blood of a calf, which is boiled in oil, or with the fat of a rattlesnake. Okay?
Oh, wow.
All right, now, sages, pay attention here. A mixture of six fats, namely those of the horse, the hippopotamus, the crocodile, the cat, the snake, and the ibex, to prevent hair loss. I don't know. Now, listen carefully here. Listen to what I'm saying. If the Bible was what that guy was saying it is, then these kinds of things would be in the Bible. There are many sort of medically related things that are in the Bible. Not once, not ever. Let's look at some of the prescriptions in the Bible. some of the medicines, not in the Bible. I must be tired. I'm kind of jet lag, you know, 3 hours of jet lag there. I got like 2 hours sleep last night, so forgive me. But anyway, some of the prescriptions in Papyrus Ebers: lizard's blood, swine's teeth, putrid meat. There's some good medicine right there. All right, moisture from pig's ears. Ah, excrement, human excrement. All right, great. Now, we're laughing at this, but actually this is very, very sad, and this is absolutely tragic, right? The average lifespan back then was roughly 20 years. Not that people couldn't live to be 60 or 80, they could, but almost everybody died from some kind of infectious disease for which they had these kinds of treatments. There was one exception. Think about this. What cultures have a continuous history for over 3,500 years? There's the Indian culture, the Chinese culture, the Egyptian culture, and the Jewish culture. They don't seem to fit that group very well. Well, I think one of the reasons for this is because of the laws that they were given in the Old Testament. There's a very interesting passage that you just skip in a few seconds. It's in Exodus 15:26, where God says to his people, if you follow the laws and decrees I'm giving you today, I will not bring on you the diseases of these other people. All right? Just some examples. Leviticus 11. I'm sure everybody in this audience is at least somehow aware that there are certain meats the Jews were allowed to eat and certain ones they were not allowed to eat. Now, we could say, well, it's just a random thing or just God making rules because God likes to make rules. That's just the kind of God that's out there. He's just a rule-making machine or something like that. Okay, that's a possible explanation. But how about this? Beef, yes. Pork, no. Well, there's at least 20 known diseases that are carried by pork. Trichinosis is one of them. Now, with modern health practices, pork is safe, but I still say cook it all the way through, all right? Beef is safe, even raw. I was in a restaurant in Venezuela a few years ago. I speak Spanish. I didn't know what was the menu, though. I said, bring me that. They brought me a plate of raw beef. Awesome. I thought about Leviticus 11, and I went for it. All right, how about this? Fish with scales? Yes. Shellfish? No. And again, shellfish is, you know, raw clams. Massachusetts people, raw clams, raw oysters. Shellfish is dangerous. There's a lot of diseases. But fish is safe to eat, even raw. In fact, every meat on the do eat list is relatively safe. Fact. Every meat on the don't eat list is relatively dangerous. Fact. And all the other peoples ate all these things. And that's what you have in the Bible. If this was the only example, I would say good evidence, but not like completely overwhelming evidence. But there's so many more examples. All right, now, in case you think, well, I don't know, the Jews just were good at this kind of stuff. I don't know, they're really good at medical things or something. I don't know. That sounds like a racial stereotype to me. But anyway, here's an ancient Hebrew manuscript writing discussing medical things, okay? So, for example, here we go, the gnat, feeble creature, taking in food but never secreting it. Stop right there. So, in other words, according to this very smart and intelligent Jewish writer on medical issues, flies don't have poop. Now, is that true? No, that's not true. See, that's an error. And I'm telling you, there's not one in the Bible. Not one. Okay? Let me see. Taking in food but never secreting it is specific against the poison of the viper. So, by the way, if you want to have this antidote for a snake bite, you have to have a jar of flies sitting around. Because you get bitten by a snake, you don't have time to kind of catch flies and stuff like that. All right, I don't think that worked. Again, what's my point? My point is not to laugh at these people. In fact, this is tragic. But the point is, never, ever does the Bible have any example like this. Instead, we have things like this. Whoever touches the dead body of anyone will be unclean for 7 days. He must purify himself with the water on the third and the seventh day. Take some hyssop, dip it in the water, sprinkle the tent and furnishings and the people who were there. All right? So there's this law which seems really cruel, harsh, that if you touch a dead body, you're unclean. You're separate from the people for 7 days. So that means the people who prepare the body for the funeral can't even attend the funeral. What's up with that? Well, I don't know. One of the rules that we're going to learn from this is, if God says so, just do it, okay? Even if you don't know why, just do it anyway, because if you do, you're going to be better off. All right, young people, let's remember that. Okay, now, I know, again, I don't know why. The Bible doesn't say why. But let me just tell you the facts. Here, his name is Ignaz Semmelweis. I was teaching this lesson in Budapest, in Hungary, and I said, yeah, this guy is Serbian. And afterwards, somebody came up and was very humbly and said, no, he's actually... he's actually Hungarian. I said, I think he's Serbian. And he took me to his house. So there I'm at Semmelweis' house. So apparently he is Hungarian. Anyway, he was working in a hospital in Vienna. It was a woman's hospital. The death rate was 18%. In other words, of those who checked into the hospital, more than 1 out of 6 died in the hospital. There's a reason women didn't have babies in hospitals back then, because it was really, really dangerous. Now, Semmelweis, what he noticed is the doctors would come in the morning, they'd go down to the morgue, they'd examine the women, the bodies of those who died, and then proceed immediately up to the wards and treat the living patients. Now, we cringe at that. But the idea of germ theory had not been invented at this time. So what Semmelweis said is, whenever you touch a dead body, you are unclean. You clean your hands very, very thoroughly with soap and water. The death rate went down from 18% to 2%. But the Bible actually has another thing, which says that when women give birth or even have their period, they're unclean. Why would God say that? Because everyone knows that God hates women. No, I think it's because he loves them. Because when are women most susceptible to infections? Well, you figure it out. So what Semmelweis said is, from now on, even between living patients, if you touch them, you clean your hands thoroughly with soap and water. The death rate went down to 0.5%. But here's an additional little kicker. What the Bible said is, if you touch a dead body, you clean yourself and all the items you touch with a mixture of hyssop, water, and ashes from the red heifer sacrifice. Now, if you mix this very, very oily herb, hyssop, with water and ash, you make soap. But the oil of hyssop contains 10% of this molecule right here, thymol. Now, I teach organic chemistry, and one of the functional groups in organic chemistry are phenols. Trust me, that's a phenol, okay? Right, chemists out there? It's a phenol, yes. Okay, good. Well, what I tell my students is, one of the most important properties of phenols is that they're antiseptics. In other words, they're not poisonous, but they kill bacteria. You know that smell, that kind of chemically smell in a hospital? You know what it is? It's thymol or related compounds. In other words, God's prescription, if you touch a dead body, is to clean yourself thoroughly on the first and seventh day and everything you touch with a powerful antibacterial soap. How did Moses know that? Okay. Then there's quarantine. Again, very harsh and very cruel. With certain skin diseases, you were separated from every human contact till the day you died, unless you can prove to the priest that you no longer had that disease. All right, leprosy was the most feared disease in the ancient world. It didn't kill the most people. Cholera killed more people. Malaria killed more people. Yellow fever killed more people. But it's the way that it killed people. It's horrifying. Let's leave that slide right away. Okay, it wasn't until the 16th century that some monks in Scandinavia said, let's try it. They were reading Leviticus, and they said, let's try it. Let's try quarantine. Within 100 years, leprosy had virtually disappeared everywhere in Europe, simply by applying this simple measure. By the way, today, if somebody has leprosy, probably better to give them an antibiotic. Leprosy is an entirely curable disease. All right, a couple more. All right, two more. Here's one, Leviticus 17, 14. It says, the life of every creature is in its blood. That is why I've said to the Israelites, you must not eat the blood of any creature, because the life of every creature is its blood. Anyone eats it must be cut off. Now again, the Bible makes these kind of statements. It doesn't explain them, all right? But when you apply them, it works. But what's interesting is these things have a spiritual meaning as well. The Bible has lepers. There's a spiritual meaning behind that. And even the whole idea of the life is in the blood. Hello, Christians? The life is in the blood. See a spiritual application there? Now, do you know what the most common medical treatment for infectious disease was throughout the 18th and 19th centuries in the Western world? Bloodletting. Because the theory was, if you have an infectious disease, the disease is in the blood. Which makes perfect sense. Except it's not true. So the Bible said the life is in the blood. Medical science said the disease is in the blood. Well, which one was right? Well, if you have an infectious disease, what's the craziest thing you could do? Drain out your blood. Because that's where our immune system is located. That's where the leukocytes and lymphocytes and all those other ites that I don't know about because I'm not a biologist. All right, so probably, by the way, it's believed that probably George Washington died from so many bloodlettings, not from the disease he had. One more example. And here I'm stepping outside of the law of Moses. I'm going back to Abraham and Genesis. So God said to Abraham, on the eighth day, circumcise every male child. All right, two questions. Number one, why circumcision? And number two, why the eighth day? Now, the answer is, I don't know. But I do know if you do this, it protects you against certain diseases. Okay, so why circumcision? Well, gee, let's think about it. Almost everybody back then died from an infectious disease, usually either fungus or bacteria. And fungus and bacteria thrive wherever it's warm, wet, and dark. So where's the warmest? You see where I'm going already. All right. She's laughing over there. All right. Forming this picture and then trying to change the picture really quickly. All right. So I'll finish my question. What's the warmest, wettest, darkest place on a guy? Okay. Now, how many lives were saved? And by the way, it was mostly women's lives that were saved. All right. Did you know that circumcision has been proved? Multiple studies have shown that circumcision produces a 60% drop in the male-to-female spread of AIDS. Simple male circumcision. So in Africa, they're now starting to do circumcision programs for adult men. Okay. You know what? I believe the Bible has a much better way to prevent the spread of AIDS. You know what I'm talking about? One man, one woman, for a life. How many diseases would be solved by that one? But why the eighth day? Again, the Bible doesn't say, and I'm going to propose an answer. Whether it's the reason or not, you know, you have to decide for yourself. But I think I know the reason. It turns out if you circumcise an infant, a newborn infant, that's very dangerous. And here's why. Turns out that vitamin K does not pass through the placenta from mother to child. So the child, the infant, has no vitamin K at all. By the way, it's not the vitamin K that causes the blood clot. It's actually prothrombin, which is a protein produced by vitamin K. And the brand new infant does have some prothrombin from his mother, his or her mother, his in this case, right? Because I'm talking about a boy being circumcised. But it's a relatively low thing. Then what happens is the baby eats bacteria, large intestine. That bacteria produces vitamin K. And so what happens is the baby starts to produce prothrombin. All right, so I'm going to show you a graph. The graph is going to be amount of prothrombin in the blood versus number of days after born. And here it is. Okay. So, from the day a male child is born to the day that male child dies, what is the safest day to perform a circumcision? The ninth is just as good as the eighth, and the seventh is just as good as the eighth. You know, why eight? You know, the Jews, the number three, that was kind of a big deal for the Jews, or seven or 12, but why eight? All right. Now, here's my idea on how Abraham figured this out. What he did was he did a double-blind scientific experiment. All right. Oh, you don't believe that. All right. Thank you for laughing. Okay. So, now, like I said, I'm a chemistry and physics professor for 35 years. I believe the Bible is the inspired word of God. And, you know, I agree with Galileo, who said the Bible was written to tell us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. That's a great quote from Galileo. So the Bible is not a science book, but let me repeat what I already said. Every single time the Bible makes statements which are checkable against science, it works out. Now, again, though, the reason I believe the Bible is inspired by God is not because of that scientific evidence. That's pretty cool stuff. But let's say, here's all the evidence, and here's all the reason to believe the Bible is from God. Of this, like this much of it is science, and there's all the other stuff I didn't talk about tonight. Maybe we'll do something on Sunday morning, maybe something tomorrow night. All right. But anyway, that ends my presentation. And it's still fairly early. It's a weekend, you know, so we can take questions for maybe half an hour, 45 minutes. Questions of any sort. If you ask me who's the right person to vote for in the election, I won't tell you that. But theological questions, biblical questions, scientific questions, let's go for it.
All
right. All right.
In the beginning of the Bible at Genesis, it talks about the various different lineages, and it often talks about people living for several hundred years.
Yeah.
Do you have an explanation for that, any kind?
Well, you know, I would say there's more than one possible explanation of that. One of those is that the Jews used numbers in symbolic ways. So whether the original recipients of that literature took that to be literal or not is maybe a little bit debatable. But let me propose a possible answer. And again, it's just my speculation. See, I got a question on my website just a couple days ago. If Adam and Eve were the parents of all generations, how come there's black and white people and all these other things? It's called mutations, and this is a normal thing. And so I believe that this is just my understanding, okay? I don't have a Bible verse on this. But I believe the original humans created in the image of God were more perfect genetically than we are. All right, and then mutations happen from that, which might possibly explain these expanded lifespans. By the way, one thing that's important to remember here is, as a believer, and I am a believer, all right, I believe that Jonah really was swallowed by a large fish, all right, and I believe Adam and Eve are real people. As a believer, it's very important to separate the things we believe because of the evidence from the things we believe because we have reason to believe the Bible is inspired by God. For example, I believe the Bible is inspired by God because of the evidence. I believe the universe was created because of the evidence. I believe life was created because of the evidence. I believe Jesus was raised from the dead on the third day because of the evidence. But I believe in heaven because it says it in the Bible. And I believe these people lived longer time for one reason only, because it says so in the Bible. So I can produce a possible rational explanation of that. Take it for what it's worth. Okay? Yeah. Well, I'd say it's a testament to evolution. By the way, some people think evolution is a plot of Satan to destroy Christianity. Now, I believe the inventor of evolution is God. And if God invented evolution, we should probably give him credit for it, not Satan, who doesn't deserve any credit for that, because he didn't invent it. And see, living species need to be able to respond to changes in the environment. Otherwise, that species disappears. And so this process we call evolution, I believe, is part of God's plan in order to allow change to happen over time. Now, given enough time, enough mutations will happen so that people produce either more melanin or less melanin. Those produce more melanin living near the equator will have more children who survive to adulthood more because they'll have a lot less cancer. And besides, they have plenty of vitamin D anyway. They don't need it. On the other hand, those who have way too much melanin who are living in the 40th or 50th or 60th degree of latitude didn't get enough vitamin D, et cetera, et cetera. So over time, different racial features were created, I believe, through random mutations and through a process of evolution. By the way, humans have very little genetic variety compared to almost all other species. Think about dogs. Dogs have way more genetic variety. We got this dog and these kinds of dogs. humans all go back to a relatively recent creation event. I'm calling it a creation event, which I admit is a biased thing to say, honestly. So, yeah, I believe these things. For example, one very dangerous mutation creates sickle cell. And if you have two, it's a recessive gene. If you have two of those, that's bad. But one sickle cell, one recessive gene, provides protection against malaria. So that's why that gene exists still in the population, because for those who live in high malaria areas, it protects against malaria. So I would say evolution. Now, you're saying, but it also shows the glory and intelligence of God. I don't disagree with you at all. But I do believe God uses physical processes. And whoever thinks evolution is the enemy of Christianity, I think maybe should rethink that idea. All right? By the way, I don't believe random evolution explains everything, but it certainly explains a lot. Okay, we'll take a question from way back there. Yes? Yeah. No, I mean, you have to understand, I can't give you percentages. I've taken one course in evolution. I'm not an evolutionist. But let's just say, for the sake of argument, 99% of all mutations have no effect. And then 1% of mutations are harmful, and 0.0001% of mutations are helpful. Okay? And so, of course, there's different kinds of diseases. There are infectious diseases caused by microbes, and then there's genetic diseases. So genetic diseases are the result of genetic accidents. You say, well, how could an all-powerful God allow for such a thing to happen? Well, I'd say it's really not God's job to prevent people from dying. We all die. That's not a tragedy from God's perspective. I'm going to talk about this Sunday morning, by the way. But the fact is that mutations happen. Without that, we have no evolution. Without that, we don't have adaptation over time. But the bottom line is, some diseases are produced by genetic mutation. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question or not. Am I or am I not? Sort of. Okay. You want to expand just a little bit? Which is all of them, as far as I know. Okay?
I'll get back to you.
Are you sure?
I have to.
All right, that's fine. Okay. I see from way back there. I'm going to go here, then back there, okay? Go ahead.
First of all, thank you so much for coming.
Sure.
You're a great speaker. This is a very interesting talk, so thank you.
Thanks.
That was a very interesting example, the one you gave with the phone and
yeah.
Design. So the reason the iPhone has so much design in it is because we can't snap our fingers and make an iPhone run on milk. So I've seen some arguments that say, well, we see all this design in nature, and the reason is because there's obstacles to overcome, but God is all-powerful, so doesn't that contradict itself a little bit? If he's all-powerful, why the need to overcome all these physical
obstacles? Okay, so you could argue, why didn't God just snap his finger and create all species rather than to create them through a process? You could have your conversation with God if you want on that one. I do know this. The idea of it taking such a long time from God's perspective, what's the difference? God exists outside of time. I mean, God creates through processes. That's just a thing about God, is he does things through processes. And for you, for a relatively young person who hasn't thought about Christianity for very long, you may not even quite get what I mean by that. But one of the things that we learn in theology is God creates through processes. Again, why does he do that? Because that's his nature. All right. All he needs is one planet. So what's this other galaxy over here? What's that doing over there? You know, why would God create physical laws? Why doesn't he just snap things into existence? Well, number one, he didn't. Apparently he didn't. It doesn't seem that way. By the way, he could have, but as far as I know, he didn't. And God creates through processes, and those processes act over time, which gives more glory to God. Boom, or creation through a process. I guess it's a little bit debatable. So I'm not really answering your question. I'm just sort of speaking philosophically, doing the best I can. Okay? I don't know if that... Okay, let's go back here.
You explained the predicament of DNA and proteins as a chicken and egg.
Yeah.
What do you think about the RNA world?
Okay, yeah. There's the RNA world. Now, it turns out... the guy who discovered that RNA world idea and got the Nobel Prize for it, his lab was directly above my lab at the University of Colorado. He got the Nobel Prize. They flooded us several times. Now, it turns out, here's the deal. In order for life to exist, you have to have a system that maintains and passes along information. And you also have to have a system that performs chemical reactions. Okay, it turns out that RNA has some very, very, very limited catalytic properties, but not very many and hardly at all. And it also has very, very limited ability to maintain information. So this idea of the RNA world was created. But there's a problem with the RNA world. Number one, there's absolutely no evidence for it. And number two, RNA is very bad at successfully passing along information. And it's also very bad at catalyzing any kind of reaction other than a very, very narrow range of reactions. So I believe the RNA world idea was created not because of any evidence that makes it a believable theory, but because people are trying to find a way to get around the chicken and egg problem. All right, so again, I made the statement that it's like the chicken and the egg, and even as I said it, I knew it's not like I don't know that there's this little workaround, which he busted. You know, he mentioned that workaround. And the workaround is that rather than using DNA as the thing to maintain information and proteins to do all the work, there's one substance that could do both, so the original life could have been made entirely out of RNA. But like I said, RNA is very, very inefficient at catalyzing things and can catalyze only a very, very narrow range of things. In fact, it's not likely it even had that function early on. And also, unlike DNA, which is fantastically, incredibly faithful in reproducing this information, RNA is not good at that at all. Okay, so no evidence for it. In fact, the evidence says it's very, very unlikely that it could have worked even if you wanted it to. Okay, I'm going to take a question back here. Yep. Talks about what? It talks about fruits and vegetables. Oh, Well, you know, I don't know what Adam and Eve were eating, but I'm pretty sure that they had teeth like this. And so it seems like they're omnivores. Humans have always been omnivores. So we have teeth back here for eating vegetables. And these teeth up here are terrible at eating vegetables. All right, so you see your dogs, and they got all those canine teeth. Dogs, mainly meat, maybe a little bit of vegetables. Then you see your cows. They don't have anything like this. So I believe that all the scientific archaeological evidence says that humans always did both. And I believe that the physiology says that humans always did both. So we are adapted to eating both meat and vegetables. Now, there's certain Calvinistic philosophical, theological interpolations from the Genesis story that say that before the fall, humans did not eat meat, and you know that the leopard lay down with the lamb and all that kind of stuff. But that's not true. Lions were eating animal, you know, they were eating animals, and cows were eating plants long before the fall of mankind. And by the way, it rained before that as well, so that's another Calvinistic thing. Okay, I think I pointed to you earlier, and then okay, great.
You mentioned in your lecture, you said something about like the best way to prevent AIDS is, or something, like one man, one woman.
Right. I mean, we're talking about STDs, right?
Leviticus has those lines, thou shalt not lie with.
Right. So I believe if human beings would have one man, one woman married, faithful to each other sexually for life, that, well, I don't believe it's, you know, AIDS would go away, obviously, and that's one disease. That wouldn't eliminate all disease. It would eliminate only a fairly narrow range of diseases, syphilis, gonorrhea, etc. But STDs would just stop in their tracks immediately if people would simply be sexually faithful to one partner.
But we know that homosexuality does exist in nature. Like there are, it does exist in animals, and like it exists naturally. Mm-hmm. So if that is the case, why would homosexuality exist in nature?
You're talking about like homosexuality amongst chimpanzees or something like that?
Or even like in people, like we know that like it's not a choice.
That we're going down a sensitive topic, but let's go ahead and tread on that sensitive topic, okay? So first of all, one thing that I think is quite clear is that the Bible specifically says sex between two people of the same sex is sinful and wrong. Okay, now we could argue for why that is. I think it's quite clear that the anatomy of men and women is, you know, correct for men and women to have sex. But God specifically said that we should not do that. All right, and so we could talk about why, all right, God's in his wisdom said one man, one woman for life. I believe men and women complement each other in a way that's awesome and amazing. The whole family idea of a father and a mother, that's God's plan. Now, I know a lot of people don't like that plan. I do believe that it is entirely possible that some people are genetically more predisposed in that way. All right. It's also true that some people are genetically more predisposed to alcoholism. Other people are more genetically predisposed to anger. So all of us probably have some sort of genetic predisposition in a direction that involves things that God says are not good for us. And therefore, because God says they're not good for us, I believe we should obey that. But I think for those of us who are heterosexual, if we look at somebody who's genetically predisposed in that direction, we should be very sensitive and not start judging. All right. And the fact is, if you have a woman who's attracted to other women, I don't think it's a sin to feel that attraction. Because I'm attracted to women. But it's not so good for me to go having sex with other women other than my wife. All right. And so I don't think people who have homosexual feelings are any more or less sinful than people who have heterosexual feelings. All right. But I believe God's plan, I know from the Bible that God's plan is one man, one woman. And I believe that physiology certainly is like that. And the fact that animals do it, well, animals do a lot of things that we don't do. You know, I'm not pointing at you, but if somebody wants to say, well, animals do it, therefore humans should do it. Seriously, is that your standard for ethics and morality? Again, I don't say that to demean anybody. This is a very sensitive topic, and I just said something that people laughed about. But this is not a laughing topic, honestly. I want to be sensitive. And one of the things that bothers me is certain Christian groups, they just go after homosexuals as if they're the worst of sinners. Why are you going after them? I mean, you got adultery in your churches. Maybe you should go after that. You know, homosexuality should be illegal. Well, maybe adultery should be illegal. I mean, you know, if that's the job of our government to tell people what to do, I'm not sure that's the job of our government. All right. Now, for me as a Christian, whether it is or it is not illegal, that's not really my main concern. So my main concern is to be righteous. And so people who are attracted to them of the same sex, a good friend of mine, Guy Hammond, he was preaching at my church a few years ago. He's been in the ministry for 20-something years. He got up in front of the church and said, by the way, I'm gay. You know, wow, we got quiet in that church. And he says, now I'm married. I've got a wife and three children. And, you know, I have a great sex life with my wife, but I'm just telling you, when I have lust, my lust is for guys. All right? Amen, I guess, you know? All right. Did I handle that well enough to move on? Okay. I'm going to... You're going to be next, okay, but I'm going to take this question here. I don't think that's true. I mean, I would say what he said is, so far there's absolutely no evidence supporting the idea that a proclivity towards homosexual thoughts has any genetic connection. There's many opinions about that. I'm not going to wade into the side of evidence. But I believe that almost certainly, whether they found it or not yet, almost certainly it will end up being true. I mean, if I can say this without getting in trouble, just look around, you know. And I'll talk to my friend Guy. It's not like he sought this out. It's not like, you know, there's these ideas it's because of effeminate husbands or weak husbands and stuff like that. The evidence doesn't support that. It just doesn't. All right. Anyway, I'm not going to debate with you on that. I would say there is some evidence supporting that idea, but no, at this point, there's no specific genetic marker for homosexuality. I agree that that's true. All right. There is some less direct evidence that it is genetically linked, but I believe, as a scientist, there's a very high probability at some point that this will come out. And so we as Christians, you know, probably shouldn't fight against that as if that would sort of hurt our case or something like that. Because like I said, all of us are genetically predisposed, I believe, to one kind of sin or another. And so the question is, what are you going to do about it? Are you going to take responsibility for your actions or not? Okay? I think I said I would take one from back there. Yeah. Okay, first of all, there's two things. There's two questions. Number one, how did life start? Right? And then how were species created? So, got that? So, evolution is not a theory of how life began. Evolution is a theory of how life changed after it had begun. Remember I had the quote from Charles Darwin who said, it is mere rubbish to think of the origin of life itself. So I'm completely convinced that life was created. And I believe that the Bible also says that life was created. And that the Bible also says that God created every form of life. All right? And so then the question is, because Genesis is not a science book, there's the question of process. Now, I believe with things like the Cambrian explosion, I do not believe that it's fully random. In other words, I do not believe just living things randomly mutating, here we are. I just don't think it worked that way. I believe Adam and Eve were specially created. All right? In other words, God says, there's Adam, there's Eve. And I believe that God has not allowed life to change completely at random over time. That's the position I would take. I've got a CD set here, Four Christian Views of Evolution, somewhere over here. Here we go. And so that's the position I take on that. But, you know, I really don't know. So we got to separate in our mind two things. One is, how was life itself created? I believe the only possible explanation is that it was created by a supernatural creator. Now, once life existed, the question is, does evolution explain the entire process of basically, you know, bacteria to humans? I believe it does not. All right? But I can't prove scientifically that it does not, and this is something that's debated. I think most biologists are totally sort of swallowed up by this evolutionary theory, and they think of everything in terms of evolution. Most biologists would probably say it was a fully natural process. Even Christian biologists tend to. I don't agree with that. Most mathematicians and people outside of biology are more likely to be skeptical of a fully random process. Okay, I don't know who to... Okay, yeah. See, that's she's smart. But you're not, you don't want me to ask... You want your friend to ask you a question. Okay, great. All right. So that's a great question. So he said, you're telling me you believe that Adam and Eve were a special creation by God. There you go. And he says, what about Australopithecus? And what about Neanderthal? And what about these other sort of proto-human-like sort of links, if you will, between... I would say this. The idea of common descent is not a crazy, stupid, ridiculous idea. What I'm talking about is, for example, I'm going to tell you every single species that does not produce vitamin C, every species of mammal. The only mammals that do not produce vitamin C are humans, gorillas, chimpanzees, bonobos, orangutans, and I might be forgetting one other great ape, and guinea pigs. All right? Now, obviously, all those primates, we have the gene to make vitamin C, but it's apparently a genetic mutation happened. So it seems to not be a coincidence. Come on now. Bonobos, chimpanzees, orangutans, gorillas, humans don't make vitamin C. And by the way, the genetic mutation that caused guinea pigs to not make vitamin C is a different mutation. So what I'm trying to say is the idea of common descent of humans with other primates is not a stupid, ridiculous idea. It's not. The genetic evidence is consistent with that idea. All right, so how do I deal with that plus what the Bible says? Well, you know, I believe what the Bible says. So God created Adam and Eve, who were intelligent, thinking, self-aware creatures, and then they displaced these other things that were already there? That's a possibility. In fact, I was just watching a National Geographic show just a couple days ago, and they proposed exactly that, that there were other types of intelligent hominids, and humans displaced them over time.
What about our Neanderthal, DNA?
Right. Humans, apparently there was some stuff going on, you know? Apparently. Yes? It's kind of weird to think about, but apparently that was happening. What he's talking about, the fact that especially humans from Europe, from Northern European, have usually 3 or 4% of DNA in common with Neanderthals. Because the Neanderthal DNA genetic sequence has been done. So, okay. Apparently that was happening. By the way, I have no idea when Adam and Eve lived. By the way, you know, Another possible idea, I don't ascribe to this idea. Another possible idea is there was intelligence involved, but not self-aware, not in the image of God, you know, early humans, and God said, all right, Adam and Eve, boom, boom. You are imago Dei. You are now, you have self-consciousness, you're self-aware. You have ethics and morality and the ability to create and freedom of will. And so God took an evolved thing and just went, there you go. I don't ascribe to that idea. I have friends who are Christians who do. I don't know. I'm an agnostic. I don't know. I don't know what happened. Okay, so, but here's what I believe. I believe God made Adam and Eve in his image, that everyone in this room is a direct descendant of that miraculous action of God. Okay, now that I'm over here, but that's not working anymore. Pointing isn't working anymore. All right, okay, there you go. All right. What do you mean? Well, dinosaurs lived starting around 240 million years ago. The last of the dinosaurs died out around 65 million years ago. Although some people believe birds are indirectly descended from dinosaur, mammals came up as a separate creation. What else is there to think about dinosaurs? Obviously, they lived a really, really, really long time ago. You don't find dinosaur DNA and woolly mammoth DNA and human DNA and giraffe DNA in the same place because they didn't exist at the same time. So let's talk about the young Earth. It's the elephant in the room. I haven't talked about it yet. So let's talk about the young Earth. I'm just going to take a little while on this one. All right. So what about those 6 days of creation? Are those literal days of creation? Now, I believe, and by the way, I talk about this in my secular philosophy of science class at Grossmont College. Because I have a lot, East County, San Diego, there's a lot of conservative people, a lot of young earthers in my class. So I say, all right, I want to talk for a minute about the idea of the young earth. So what I do, literally in class, I say, I'm going to walk over there, and I'm going to speak as a theologian, not as a scientist for a while. They don't realize that I teach theology. But anyway, so I go over here and I say, all right, so let's speak theology for a minute. Let's assume for the sake of argument there exists an all-powerful, all-knowing, all those omni-gods. Could that God create the earth with an appearance of age? And, of course, everybody in the class says yes, because from what I said, obviously it's true. So if God did that, then the earth would appear old. Could this all-powerful God that we believe in do that? Of course he could. So then the question is whether he did do that or not. So the young earth idea is not stupid or ridiculous. It is not. Here's what I want to ask those who believe in the young earth please to do. Don't tell us that it's scientific. Because the earth appears old, okay? Every single piece of scientific information tells us the universe appears old, the earth appears old. Okay, got it? So I believe those days represent the things that God did over time. I believe that those days are metaphorical. Philo, the Hebrew, the Jewish philosopher of the first century said that those days are metaphorical. Origen, the Christian philosopher in the third century said those days are metaphorical, representing periods of time over which God worked. All right, but you know, to me, the idea, the 6 day literal thing, is not ridiculous or stupid. All right, it's just if God wanted to do that, he could. John the Baptist said God could create children of Abraham from these stones. I believe it. Now, I personally don't believe that's what happened. Okay, for example, we look through a telescope at a galaxy that's a billion light years away. Got it? So how long ago did that light leave that galaxy? It's a billion light years away. Got it? Got it? So how long did the light How long ago did the light leave that galaxy that's hitting the telescope? A billion years ago. So if you go for the young Earth idea, then my question is, does that galaxy even exist or not? Now, God could create a universe with the light sort of already on the way, but why would he do that? And why would he put dinosaur fossils in the ground if there were never any dinosaurs? To me, that's I don't believe that, okay? So I believe these days of creation represent the periods over which God worked. And the fact is, basically, the Genesis says, first there was light, then there was planets, and then there was water covering the earth, and then land emerged from the water, and then life appeared in the water, then life appeared on the land, and last of all, we appeared, which is consistent with what I know. All right, I'm going to go over here. Which one of you wants to ask the question? Are you in on it together?
John, one more question.
Last one. All right, there you go.
All right, I'll go for it.
Yeah. All right.
So on the early thing, I don't really have contextual evidence, but I had heard of a theory that the Earth is not as old as people say it is.
Based on what?
Part of that, I believe, was that carbon dating.
Okay.
Is
flawed. Okay. First of all, carbon dating, carbon 14 has a half-life of 5,700 years. All right, so therefore, anything older than about 30,000 years cannot be dated using carbon 14. So I'll tell you right now, carbon 14 has absolutely nothing to do with the evidence for the age of the Earth. So whoever said that clearly doesn't know what they're talking about. Now, are there accuracy, precision issues with related to carbon 14 dating? Yes. So plus or minus 10%. What's that have to do with dinosaur fossils that are 127 million years old? That involves uranium, thorium, lead dating methods. The fact is, there are multiple methods of measuring the ages of things. Is there some uncertainty? Yes. Could it be 80 million instead of 70 million? Sure, it could be. But could it be 3,000? No, So what if instead of 4 billion, it's 2 billion? What's the difference? Who cares? It doesn't matter. So people who say the Earth appears to be a few thousand years old, they are wrong. They're flat out wrong. And so these people like to sow confusion in your mind for reasons that they can answer for. They try to sow doubt about the scientific information as if there was any doubt. It's kind of like, it's like climate change. People try to sow doubt. They don't have evidence that it's not true. They just try to sow doubt to make you just not accept where the science is headed. Here's how I handle it with my Science 110 students. I say, what does the evidence from from uranium, thorium, lead dating say about the age of the Earth? 4.5 billion years. Thank you very much. And then I say to them, does that mean the Earth is 4.5 billion years old? My students say, no, it doesn't mean that. Why not? Because science produces only tentative conclusions. All right? But to say that the evidence is the Earth is a few thousand years old, that is not true. So I don't know the thing exactly you're talking about, but there is no evidence the Earth is a few thousand years old. Oh, we said it's the last one, but you're sitting. All right, you're sitting next to him, so we'll let us, you sneak it in.
There's a lot of stuff, and it seems to me that the evidence is actually quite overwhelming to me that the Earth is young. There's a lot of evidence. In fact, it's amazing, and I'd like for you maybe comment on that. Like, what is carbon 14 and why it's being found like everywhere, basically, even inside the middle of diamonds and things like that? And also, can you comment on soft dinosaur tissue fossils? Soft dinosaur tissue fossils?
Yeah. I answered that at my website. You could go there. It turns out, for example, what he's talking about is they have found, in quotes, soft tissue from dinosaurs that apparently is at tens of millions of years old. And then what you find in that is that, in quotes, soft tissue, that's an exaggerated description. What it has is certain compounds. It's not flesh. It's not tissue. It's certain compounds, remnant compounds. And these are the kinds of compounds that stay stable literally for many, many millions of years. So I've read those articles. You go to my website. I address that very directly. All right. And then these young earth people take a scientific article out of its context and try to make it say something that it just does not say. If you look at that, what they have is there are certain fossilized material that is not fully fossilized, which is remarkable and amazing. But if you look at those materials, things that only last for several tens of thousands of years are not present. Things that only last for hundreds of thousands of years and even a couple million years, those also are not present in those. The only things that are present in those samples are substances that we know can last literally for tens of millions of years. So rather than the evidence, which I know young earthers want to spin it in a certain direction, if you look at the evidence, it doesn't point in that direction. So why do they spin it in that direction? Okay, there's the thing about carbon-14. He opened the question, all right? It turns out that, we did a debate with a young earther. It's got it over here. He raised that one. It turns out that there's an extremely, extremely, extremely low level of carbon-14 found naturally, even in very old things. Right. And then ask a scientist, please, rather than publish it in your young earth journals, okay? The fact is there is background radiation. And due to background radiation, anything that has carbon in it is going to have this tiny, tiny, tiny amount of carbon-14. And that has nothing to do with decaying from naturally produced carbon-14. And all scientists know this. So why do these people publish these articles, which doesn't support their conclusion at all? So, for example, if you dig up coal will have this fantastically low amount of carbon-14 in it, which scientists know the source of. It's from background radiation. And it's not because the coal is a few thousand years old. It's just not. Okay, so, again, there's all these journals and all these things these people write, but again, it's spun in a place where there's nobody who has a different idea. So those are two examples, and I'm telling you, both of those pieces of information point to the earth being old, not to it being young. Okay, well, that's a lot of discussion on a topic a lot of you don't care about. Go to my website. If you go to my website, I've answered over 2,300 questions. In fact, probably almost every question asked tonight is answered at my website. If you go there, it's evidenceforchristianity.org. We've got cards up here. Got a few books of mine if you want to buy one. Thank you very much. I think we're done with the question and answer. Come on up. We'll go out for coffee if you want. All right, give them a round of applause. Let's just talk in a minute. Okay? Yep. But don't go away.
Sunday, tomorrow night, so we can help you out.